Imagine historians, linguists, culture writers, lawyers, sociologists, and ethnographers using cutting-edge digital modeling, statistical analysis, and complexity science to find pattern and meaning in the explosion of digital material we have created. Using computation to bring new insights to an examination of the human experience. The Santa Fe Institute, known for complexity studies, is doing just that through an NEH-funded program called Foundations and Applications of Humanities Analytics.
Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like linguistics, technology, game and object design, and ethics. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by philosopher David Kinney, an Omidyar postdoctoral fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, SFI, who is leading this new effort called Foundations and Applications of Humanities Analytics, which seeks to help new humanities scholars study culture through computational tools and complexity science. We're also joined by SFI external professor Simon DeDeo, a cognitive scientist at Carnegie Mellon University who is co-leading this new NEH effort with David, and with Carrie Cohen, SFI's Director for Education. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Before we get into some of the details of your new institute that you've created, and you call it an institute, even though it's Santa Fe Institute, this is also like a sub-institute, is that right?
So the institute language kind of comes directly out of the funding project. This is a program within the National Endowment for the Humanities to fund institutes in humanities analytics, digital humanities. But it's perhaps more convenient or more evocative to just think of it as an online course, an in-person workshop, a sort of educational programming that we're developing.
Okay. So before we get into some of the details of your new educational platform, we hear this term a lot now, complexity science. What's the elevator pitch of what complexity science is, since we're going to talk about this, I think, for the next hour?
We can both give it a shot. So complexity science came out of the Los Alamos National Laboratories, actually, at least one of the main sources of people who worked in that field. And this was a bunch of physicists originally, economists, and I would say cognitive scientists. They had built a set of mathematical tools to deal with atoms, right? The things that make up your table, your desk, your computer. The thing about atoms, though, is that every single atom is identical to every other atom, right? So the kinds of tools, the kinds of phenomena you see have a very distinctive set of properties. So we got really good at that. We got really good at material science and, I guess, blowing things up. But complex systems was a plan or a goal of doing the same thing that we did for atoms for the richness of biological life and human experience. And the big difference, right, is that every human is different. We're all special eggs. And so that leads to very different kinds of phenomena. It leads to very different mathematical tools. We do a lot of simulation. And the kind of work we're doing here is, in some sense, the ultimate challenge, which is bringing these tools to bear on the historical record, on the arts and literatures of the cultures here in the U.S. and beyond.
Yeah, and just to piggyback on that, you know, I'm a philosopher by training, and Ludwig Wittgenstein is sort of one of the foundational figures in analytic philosophy. He talks a lot about, despite philosophers' best efforts, it's often not possible to give necessary and sufficient conditions for a lot of different sorts of concepts. Rather, different instances of that concept have what's called a family resemblance to one another. And I definitely think that's the case with complexity science. You know, I'm often asked by people, you know, how do I learn complexity science? You can't really give someone a complexity science textbook or a complex system studies textbook. What the SFI does is bring together a group of people whose research sort of bears that family resemblance to one another. And that usually means a focus on networks, a focus on scale and the way in which different levels of granularity of describing the world affect the observed behavior of a system or affect the system itself, and also a focus on non-linear and slightly more, you know, complex relationships between different things in those networks. And so what that does is bring together people from physics, people from sociology, cognitive science, biology, ecology, and then also, as we're going to discuss today, work on cultural artifacts, including some artifacts that have traditionally been considered the domain of the humanities.
This is really talking about complex systems is maybe even a better way to talk about it than saying complexity science. It's almost more meaningful in a way. I get a complex system. If I go to a rock concert, I've got a complex system of all the people interacting and all of these different kind of biases and motions and all of these things. But I can also take a step back and take a big picture view and try to see what patterns are happening in there. So with that in mind, what you're trying to do with your new educational program at SFI is look at the humanities as a complex system. Am I expressing that accurately?
Or is it looking at specific texts or historical events as complex interactions?
Ellen, I would say it's definitely the second one. Not to say that you couldn't look at the humanities as a complex system, and that might be very interesting. But in practice, I think a nice way to think about what's unique about housing a program in digital humanities or humanities analytics within the SFI is exactly that perspective of looking at a corpus, a novel, a series of novels, maybe all of Shakespeare's plays or historical records from a particular time period. Thinking of Simon's work on the Old Bailey records, right? Looking at that archive as a complex system or something like that would be one way of thinking about the kinds of research we're trying to encourage through our institute.
Simon, you're the computational person. What are your roles here in this project is what I'm asking.
There's two kinds of challenges when you want to study something like literature, history. One is, obviously, we want to work at a scale that historians traditionally haven't been able to work at. And that means drawing on tools from the computer sciences, tools that help us process language at a speed and a scale that an individual human can't. So I remember one of the smallest archives we worked with was 10 times longer than the entire Game of Thrones. So you can read Game of Thrones and maybe you remember all the characters. Right now you have 10 times that, right? So there's a real computer science challenge sitting in there. But also, and this is where David and I sort of team up, it's also a conceptual challenge. What does it mean to look at an artwork, let's say, where that artwork is giving you an experience in some ways, an irreducible experience? How do we talk about that? What does it mean to talk about that mathematically? What does it mean to talk about that as a subject of scientific study? So both of us, I think, have our roles to play. But in one sense, it's very hard to tease these apart. The mathematical questions, philosophical questions are overlapping.
For the sake of the listeners, then, you just sort of mentioned a project with records from the Old Bailey.
Yeah, this is one of the first pieces of work we did at the Santa Fe Institute now a few years ago. The Old Bailey is the sort of central criminal court in London, United Kingdom. So, you know, if you do something especially heinous, that's where they take you, and that's where they still take you now. If you ever watch some horrible thing that happened in London, right, there's some guy being dragged out of a gray building, that's the building. We had records digitized by the British government and some folks at the University of Sussex, Tim Hitchcock led that. And this archive ran from the 1650s through 1913, more than 200 years. We have witchcraft trials at the beginning. We have trials for women suffrage activists blowing up buildings, right? So it's a huge range of British history. It goes pre-industrial revolution all the way up to almost World War I. And we were interested in how people talked about evidence, right? How witnesses talked. We were interested in the ways in which people described the same crime over and over again, right? The kind of library of awful things people do is pretty consistent. But the culture surrounding it, the way we talk about, for example, violence, changed radically. And so our goal was to look at these sort of subtle shifts. They're invisible day to day, even year to year, but over a century, they become more and more apparent.
Did you actually apply some computational tools to this archive? How did you extract the information? How does this work?
what I'll do is I'll describe the computer science, then I'll punt to David and he could justify this philosophically, right? So honestly, it's just dumb, right? We just count words. We look at the types of words people use. We look at the vocabulary. We try and link words together, right? So if I say punch and you say, you know, strike a blow, okay, we kind of merge those. Yeah, that's a bit of computer magic. How are people using different groups of words? One thing we found, for example, is people started using medical terminology when they were getting punched in the face, right? 1750, someone punches you in the face, you punch them back, and if it's a fair fight, it's all right. 1890, from the point of view of 1750, everyone's a wimp, right? Everyone's like, oh, I'm going to show you my cuts, and this cut is an inch long, and it had to be sewn up. So that's the kind of thing we do. And maybe I'll punt this to David, because there's this real question. What's the relationship between word and mind?
You know, something that both Ellen and Craig talked about was this idea of pattern recognition. And I think what Simon's just described is the technical aspect of pattern recognition. How do you recognize a pattern in some data? But of course, you know, when you program a computer to recognize patterns in a data set, how you design that process is going to already reflect certain things about the hypothesis that you pose, and then how you interpret the results. One technique that gets used a lot, and I'm not saying this is exactly the technique that Simon used in his case, but one technique that gets used a lot in this kind of work is topic modeling, right? Where you try and extract certain topics from pieces of text, or, you know, you treat different portions of a text as what's called random variables and then measure the similarities or differences between them using certain techniques from information theory. All of that stuff requires a lot of interpretive work that's done by the scientist. And it's that process of sort of hypothesis posing, interpretation, some technical pattern recognition and data analysis that sort of holistically comes together to sort of give you this relationship between model, which is going to be what you're going to use to sort of communicate and extract your results and your sort of headline findings. All of that is involving this really complex interaction of sort of interpretation, data, model building. As a philosopher of science, I'm very interested in this model-world relations, how it is that a model in science represents the world. For us, in designing this course, with our target audience being scholars in the humanities, science has done a really good job of PR for itself. And one aspect of that has been a sort of sense that there's impersonal methodology that can be applied that will tell you what patterns are in your data. And I think anyone who does science will tell you that that's not quite the case, that exactly what I described of sort of this interplay of intuition, decision-making, and data analysis happens across the sciences, whether it's biology, physics, economics, etc. Really, in taking a scientific approach to the humanities, we're not doing anything that's sort of radically different.
I'm hearing that you're using really what I would think of as modern tools to do the same kinds of interpretive work that humanities scholars have been trying to do for a long time. Am I understanding that correctly?
I would say that's definitely part of it, but I would hasten to add that what we hope is that the availability of these tools, and moreover, bringing in people who are real subject matter experts in the subject matter itself, perhaps from a more traditional humanities background and standpoint, will actually lead to the development not just of better tools for answering the same research questions, but possibly by sort of expanding that space of what you can do, opening up genuinely new research questions. That's really a goal of the educational offering that we're putting together, and that's been funded by the NEH to do.
Because we were talking a little bit about pattern recognition, do you think that given these new tools, could it give rise to being able to see patterns that we never would have thought to look for that can be suggested by the outputs of this kind of analysis?
I think one of the most important things about a piece of artwork is that there's not one unique pattern sitting in there, right? Every scholar brings an interpretive frame to the work. We learn to read in different ways. What it means to be a good reader, I think, is to see the complexity of the ways in which different patterns interact. You look at it one way, this is a story about love. You read it another way, this is a story about class or race. So scientific approach to these texts needs to be, I think, augmented or made more subtle by that kind of task of looking for or drawing out one pattern over another. There is, of course, also this very exciting idea or possibility that we can not only look at patterns that other people have seen, but also try to find new patterns, things that might have been invisible to us that are sitting in there, things about the way in which literature works on the mind, the way in which history accumulates. It's possible to use these computational tools to see things we haven't seen before.
I'm going to have to go and roll. Thank you both so much. And if you all out there would like more information, you can visit santafe.edu/FAHA. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.